Accession number 10625, rule 1.
Mr. McCrary, 1. When was it and how was it that you came to join the army, Mr. McCrary?
I was called up.
When was that?
That was January 1940.
What was your reaction when you got called up?
Well, I knew I had to go, so I just went with a good heart.
Resignation,
you mean? Oh, yes. I knew that we had to go. It was our age group. I wasn't in the reserved occupation, or my age didn't carry me into reserve occupation, so I went in.
What had been your reaction when you heard war with Germany declared, if you heard that broadcast of Chamberlain?
Original thing went right back to 1938, the year of the first crisis. I was working then and we hoped there wouldn't be a war, but it looked inevitable. Then in 1939, when it came, it was just, well, it's come and that was it.
What was your attitude towards the Hitler regime?
Oh, it was total so-and-sos. I mean, we had to destroy them. They couldn't go on. They had to be destroyed.
Can you tell me what it was like when you first went to answer your call-up, going into the army and your first experience with it?
Well, it was all chaps of my own age, roughly, in several months, each age group was called up. We all went there. It was sort of a little bit of an adventure. Nobody really knew what was happening. Training was a bit of a mixture, really, laughable points, sad points, but we all got on well. We was all young, and there was always an element of adventure to it. It was something new.
How were you treated by the NCOs in the initial training?
Oh, well, we very quickly learnt that the first 6 to 8 weeks during our training period were going to be our worst from the army point of view. As even today, it's still the same. You're a rookie soldier and you've got to go and completely obey. They're turning you from a civilian into a soldier.
We hear sometimes nowadays about cruelty, either verbal or physical, to recruits that come into the army. Did you ever experience any of that?
There is a certain amount, as there always will be. Well, I saw a certain amount of it and experienced a certain amount of it, but you've got to be bold enough and hard enough to hit back at it. And I was. Both.
How do you hit back?
Well, you choose the biggest bloke and belt him one, as simple as that. You assert your authority on them. You don't let them override you.
That's relationship.
From relationship between recruits and all that. You've got to sort out, establish your place and position. You don't let them ride over you. Of course, the instructing NCOs, you've got to obey. It's yes and no, so three bags full. You go along, you make it easy for yourself.
Did you find recruits who were too meek to stand up for themselves?
Well, there was a lot of that, yes. There was a lot of chaps that came in the army, very, very meek. They weren't... Well, they wasn't in their nature to strike back and stand up for themselves a lot. You found this, as is today.
What happened to them?
Well, they got by, because, say, later on, you all became mates and you'd all help each other. But you had to learn that code in the forces. You had to learn that everyone was your mate and you was a mate to everyone else. And you all helped each other out.
Would the recruits generally intervene to stop bullying?
Sometimes, yes. But a lot of it was passed off as a laugh and a joke sort of business. It had an element you had to determine yourself how far you let a joke go and how far you stopped it. This was only experience you learned by common experience, preferably the type of life you've led in Civvy Street as to what you was getting in the army.
Did you come across abuse because of being a black person?
Once or twice, yes.
Was it any different to civilian life?
No, just the same. You expected it, you see that you found it in civilian life, and you found it in army life. and you dealt with it. In both cases, you dealt with it the same. You could, there was always a certain amount of abuse. If it was within your own, what is it, you could deal with it. But you didn't get it so much from the higher ranks, from your own ranks. There's a certain amount of it, but after a time, you became accepted. You was one of them.
When you say you didn't get it from the higher ranks, do you mean?
Well, I mean the instructing NCOs. They didn't differentiate. I didn't find it myself.
When I was talking about bullying earlier on, I meant nowadays we sometimes hear about cruelty by NCOs against the recruits, sort of swearing at them or actually.
Well, this can be stopped, providing the person who's on the receiving end knows the rule of the road. If he knows his rules and regulations, it can be stopped. He can go to a senior officer or a senior NCO and put in an official complaint. It can be done. I didn't have to.
Did you hear of that?
I've known it to be, and yes. I've known occasions when someone's of... even when I was a senior NCO, complaints have come to me about junior NCOs, you know, bullying. Not a lot, it's the odd occasion. It doesn't happen with regulars, it's not a regular occurrence. You find that as you are with a unit and you get to know everybody, everyone's accepted on the same par, on the same basis.
Is it true then that there was real comradeship between the men?
Oh yes, yeah, there is real comradeship. The longer you go and the deeper you go, there is comradeship. You recognise it. You go along with it. It's a sort of code. And it's a code that you find in all the forces. Later on, I was to find it in the Navy and the Air Force and all the same. When I was on combined operations, this code existed even between forces, even between groups.
Now, you went into the Royal Norfolks.
No, the Royal Berkshire first. I was put into the Royal Berkshire Regiment first. That's how I got a Royal Berkshire number.
How did you transfer to the Norfolks?
It was after Dunkirk. When Dunkirk came, the 2nd Division was short of troops when they came back and reformed in England. I was actually on my way to France when to France fell. We was reinforcements from the Royal Berkshire Regiment.
So you never actually got to France?
No.
Did you find much difference between the Berkshires and the Norfolks?
No, not a lot. It was just one regiment to another. We was in the Royal Berkshire, and we just transferred. I mean, we went up to Bradford and Idle, and then we just joined the remnants of the Norfolk, of course, the Norfolk Regiment itself had been badly mauled in France. And we formed the nucleus of the new division that was being formed.
You were the 2nd Battalion of the Norfolks,
weren't yes,
you?
Yes, yeah.
And which division were you in?
That was a 2 div. That was the 2nd British Division.
Can you tell me when it was and how you came to go to India?
The whole division was sent to India. At that particular time, it started off, we was originally embarked for North Africa. But when we got down to about Cape Town, all our anti-tank outfits and all that were sent up to North Africa, and we were transferred on to Bombay. And we were trained then originally for the Sicily landings, but we never got there because trouble flared up in Burma, and we were sent further into India to go. Because we did the original training, combined operations, down Portuguese Goa. Now, they were similar beaches to Sicily in Italy. But we never got there. The Burma front broke at that particular time, down the Arakan and all around that way, and we was sent deeper into India as reserve troops were there.
When you were in India, was there any civil disturbances by the population?
Yes, Gandhi and all that. We was at Ahmednagar, which was his hometown. We was engaged in more or less keeping the peace, the same as in Ireland now.
What did you see of these civil disturbances?
Well, it was riots mostly all the time, stone throwing and crowds gathering.
Who were they throwing stones at?
All authority. Anybody in authority, that was their own police or anybody that happened to be there at a particular time or in their way.
This was in Ahmednagar, was it?
This Ahmednagar, yes. Although it was going on all over the country because Mahatma Gandhi at that particular time had asked for a civil disobedience.
Do you remember the month that you were in Ahmednagar?
Oh no, we was there quite some time. Because Ahmednagar was at one time it had been an army garrison when the troops occupied India in peacetime. Like Pune and Delhi was. We was there quite some considerable time. When I say that, several months, you know.
Did you ever get stoned yourself in India?
We had stones thrown at us, yes. It was quite a common thing, really. I mean, nobody took much notice out about it. Directly you made out an attempt that you was going to charge them or chase after them, they all disappeared down, mostly at evening, night time. During the day, everybody went about their business, you know. Night time they gathered when they had nothing to do sort of business.
Was the stone throwing vicious or more of a joke?
No, it was a token thing, actually. It was a case of throw a couple of stones and run like the devil, you know.
What kind of people were doing it?
A lot of the dock workers, lowly Indians, I mean, the sweepers and all that sort of business. There was no, the more higher class Brahmin Indian didn't participate in to that degree.
Did you get students doing it?
Yes, quite a lot of students, a lot of unrest in students from the students' point of view. But as I say, it was nothing really vicious. It was stones and mostly handled by their own police. And they were far more vicious about it than where we ever thought of being. I mean, they had the long, tall, lathy bamboo canes and they'd lay into a crowd with them without second thought.
Did the crowd shout any slogans that you could hear?
Well, if they did, it was all in Hindu and all that sort of thing. There's so much shouting and noise that they never used to... We never took much notice of it.
Did they have any slogans or posters up that you could read?
No, not that I can remember. The whole thing was just civil disobedience in the fact that they'd... gathering large groups. Our antidote was that they mustn't, or our orders were that we had to break up any gathering over four people. They used to get large groups and shout and bawl and that, but definitely should see us coming, they all scatter. I mean, there was no sort of organised disobedience at all, it was all small stuff.
So just your presence caused
our presence,
disperse.
Yes. We did marches around all the small villages and all that outside the big towns to let know that we were there, you know. It was a more or less by sight to see that we were, our presence was there. And they had to toe the line sort of lark. That's all it was. There was no shooting or any of that sort of business.
So what did you assume all the civil disturbances were about?
Well, Gandhi wanted his home rule. He wanted us out of India altogether, which he eventually got.
Did you have any sympathy with them, or were you...
Well, we'd been there a long time, and we looked on the light that India was a gateway to the East. It was, in many ways, it was could have been properly run a very rich country with its trade and all this sort of thing. But on the other aspect, it was a very, very lowly and poor country, mainly from within itself, because it was hidebound with religion. And when I say that, I mean a Hindu was the lowest form of life known. If a Sikh, even a shadow. I've actually seen, I'll recount an incident, whereas there were some Sikh soldiers, Sikh regiment, sitting down eating their food from mess tins. And a Hindu sweeper went near them. And his shadow passed over the food, and they threw their food at him. There was always that religious element there.
How did he react?
Well, he flew for his life, because he, they would have beaten him up, as simple as that. There was this sort of thing even exists to this day. I mean, the caste system, you've got to see to believe. The Hindu is real low, and Gandhi was trying to help all this sort of business out.
What did you feel yourself about being in India? Did you like being there? Or
well, we felt that we were wasting our time, because we was outnumbered millions to one. We'd been brought out from England to maintain the peace and cover their eastern border, when there was literally millions of Indians there that could protect their own, themselves. There was a large, fairly large Indian army, but it didn't seem to be doing a lot. I mean, when we later learnt the disposition in Burma, it was mostly Empire troops. When I say Empire troops, mostly a large part was Indian. The half of it, well, big point, half of this was Indian, and the rest were made up of English troops. I mean, there was quite a small number of Indian divisions when they had a tremendous population to draw on. I mean, from the Sikh point of view, they provided quite a large amount, even Air Force as well.
Which other places were you in India besides Ahmednagar?
Oh, in Bombay, Pune, Delhi, Calcutta, Secunderabad.
And most of the time were you preparing, training to go to
Bombay? Oh, yes, yeah, yes. As each month went by, our training adopted a more of a jungle approach, and all our training was purely for the jungle then. We'd combined ops had faded out, and a new role was taking place. It was jungle all the time, and you know, from fighting from cover. And then the long-range penetration was formed, and they went deep into Burma behind the Japanese lines and that.
This was the Chindits.
This is the Chindits, and
but you weren't part of the Chindits.
We weren't part of the Chindits. No, I think we had one or two observers go from the 2nd Division. They went as purely observers. But there was one, two, and I think three different columns went in from Lido and from that way. We was kept informed of their manoeuvres and their training and all that, and we more or less followed on into their training. And then, 40, very late 43, the Japanese really, we knew that they were building up by the Chinwin, the other side of the Chinwin, and we didn't know to what strength, but then, of course, just immediately after Christmas 43, they burst across the Chinwin and came north to invade into India, the northern route, Kohima and all that. Then they cut the Kohima off completely.
Can I ask you about the jungle training that you did in India? can you tell me what you recollect of it?
Yes, it was where there was wooded country. See, Ahmanago in parts had that particular bamboo, you know, the denseness what we that was necessary. And there was outward sections as well. And we was training, moving at night patrols, daytime patrols, artillery observation, fighting patrols out, and all this thing, which came in very handy when we did go into Burma. Of course, we had to do exactly the same sort of thing in Burma itself.
How well prepared for Burma did you feel you were?
Quite well, really. We'd done a considerable amount of training, and we sort of knew what we were likely to encounter. It was just the suddenness of it, because a lot of us was on leave at the time when we got notice that the whole division was on the move. I was down, and a lot of my friends were down Bangalore, which is very much like England in its way, because it's on a, what is it? We was on leave at down Bangalore, and we suddenly got telegrams report back to all our units. And within a matter of days, we was en route for Secunderabad, where we detrained, and I think we was on a train about 4 days, and went up to the airfields, and the whole division was, and the equipment was flown in by American pilots and Dakotas and commando planes, what they called the old commando, which was a build-up of the Dakota.
Do you know when you were flown in, personally?
I went in February 1944.
You don't know the dates, do you?
I couldn't tell you the dates, no, because there was so much you had to wait sometimes a whole day, and you lost track of days. You didn't know what day it was, Friday, Saturday or Sunday, or what day it was. You just waited, and then you was just in drafts. You had mules with you, and they went in the planes with you.
Which particular company were you in?
I was, when we flew in, we was a headquarter company, carrier platoon.
What exactly is meant by carrier?
Well, Bren gun carriers, the armoured carriers. They couldn't be flown in, you see. They weighed about 9 tonne apiece. So they had to come up by boat and road.
But you personally flew in?
Well, I personally flew in, yes.
From which
airstrip? That was an airstrip in Secunderabad to Dimapur. I don't know the name of the airstrip that was one put out there, but it was in Secunderabad.
And then flew...
Probably just outside Calcutta. And then we flew straight away out. We went up there, and we went, and memory serves me, went down the Brahmaputra in barges, long, low barges, then onto the airstrip, yes. And then we'd flown into Dimapur then.
And you were a sergeant at the time?
Yes, at the time, yes.
What was the situation like at Dimapur? Was it well organised or not?
Fairly well organised, because at that particular time, although you've no doubt heard of the tennis court in Kohima, that would only just been the Royal West Kents and that were rather holding out there. And our 6th Brigade got there first to relieve them. You couldn't fly masses of troops in. You had to do what you could, you know. When we got there, it seemed to be fairly well organised. It was a case of get out a plane, be prepared. And we moved up in position straight away, in support position straight away, you know. And then we started patrol activity.
What kind
from
of-
then onwards? Well, we was on the road. I think it was the 81st milestone. We was on the road behind Kohima, and we fanned out both sides, and we sent out patrols right away deep into the undergrowth, because we had to cover to see that no Japs were coming round to cut off Kohima. It was daily occurrence to, you know, do patrol activity the whole time.
How big were these patrols?
Well, accordingly, first of all, we went out in quite large parties. You'd be a platoon strong. But we found out, I personally didn't like the big patrols, because you couldn't control them as easy as you could smaller groups. It was mass of people moving about when you wanted cover and stealth and quiet.
So what size, what did you find?
From then onwards, right the way through to all the way through the rest of the war, I always favoured a small patrol. It was my own personal thing. I preferred and thought that I could get more information and go deeper with a smaller patrol.
How big was that?
Well, I favoured 3 to 4. Myself in the lead with, say, 3 chaps behind me or something like that, in different angles, in an L-shaped formation or something like that. I knew where everybody was, and you didn't lose contact so easily. When you're moving company strength, and if you're under fire, it's so easy for the forward units to go forward and the back units to lose contact with them. I had this a year later. It could have been with disastrous results, but we turned it to our advantage.
So these patrols, when you first arrived at Kohima, how soon did you make contact with the Japanese?
Well, within a matter of days through patrol activity. I mean, they weren't far away from that aspect. We went on patrol and we were fired upon, and we fired on them on this patrol business in just a matter of days.
Can you describe what typically would happen?
Well, you go out and you are not, even like 7 or 8 strong, a section strong, in charge of an NCO, and he'd probe as deep as he could. Sometimes you went up to an area that you was asked to go to, but met for reference. You had made observation from there. If there was no activity there, you came back. But sometimes you bumped into another Japanese patrol, or perhaps they may be on the same thing as you. If you bumped them, well, then whoever saw what he'd have a first, open fire. Then if you was lucky enough, they went, or you went. It was a case of whoever was the strongest.